Lab, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. This evening's program is somewhat special. It marks the finale of this first season. And I have some good news. Innovation Alberta has won an award. The program has been recognized by the Alberta Chamber of Resources, and I'm told that in the 66-year history of the Chamber, this is only the third time this media award has been given out. So thank you very much to the Alberta Chamber of Resources. Let this evening's program be one of contemplation. First, an interview with Dr. Peter Carr of Athabasca University. His recent survey reveals some disturbing trends regarding the incorporation of information technology into our daily business operations. And Alberta teacher and playwright Gina Cravettes takes us back to the year 1632, when Galileo, the father of modern science, is summoned to answer charges of heresy before the Holy Roman Inquisition. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. My introduction to the computer back in the late 1980s was not a happy one. I came to work one day, and gone was my IBM Selectric typewriter. In its place was this thing. And about all I accomplished that day at work was figuring out where the on button was hidden. Well, it's taken me a long time to warm up to this new age of information technology, so I can certainly empathize with some of the people who participated in a recent survey about information technology, and among the highlights is IT rage. Overseeing the survey was Dr. Peter Carr of Athabasca University.
I think we're trying to look across the Canadian economy and see what's happening with technology. I think most people believe it's becoming a more important part of how businesses perform. And we're just keen to understand what's happening across the Canadian economy to help business people and politicians make the appropriate decisions to make it work better.
Now, you've hit a great number of people in this survey. How have you actually gone about getting the information?
Well, we worked with CIO Canada magazine, who have a very long email list, about 47,000 people, who both work with technology, but also are more general specialists or general managers inside organizations. So it's a great list for us to use as a foundation for a large-scale survey.
Who would be some of these people?
They're managers and professionals. They come from a wide range of companies. 96% of them describe themselves as managers and professionals. They're on average age 30 to 49, and so they're a good solid group of people. They're the people who are involved in making decisions about technology in organizations.
What kinds of things are you asking them?
Well, we asked quite a wide range, but this year I think we found there were three main areas that we asked about. We wanted to understand how they felt technology was performing inside their organization, and the extent of their confidence in working with technology over the next year. And there we found a very positive picture. We also asked about security, because that was clearly becoming more of an issue. We inserted it into the survey prior to September the 11th, when discussion had already started. And we asked more this year, and we found some, I think, quite shocking results. But the other area we looked at was the impact of technology on employees, what was happening to people's jobs, and in relation to that, to their performance related to IT across the Canadian economy.
Now, you've called this IT rage. What on earth? Too much innovation?
Well, could be. I mean, the statement or the inside our survey that allows us to claim that IT rage still exists. We originally were credited with discovering it last year, but it's basically that more people believe that stress has increased as a result of the introduction of IT-related change in their organization than believe that it's decreased over the past year. And that's a fairly serious situation, because we have taken that further and correlated it against how people perceive performance changing in their organizations. And basically, where we see more stress, we see less a less positive attitude towards the impact that IT has had. So that seems to suggest that, you know, that heavy levels of stress have a bad impact on IT performance.
Now, how is that manifesting itself, this rage?
We think in most cases that it's something that, you know, isn't resulting in extreme acts of behavior, but we do think it's resulting in stress and frustration, because basically most people, we believe, want to do their jobs well, and our sense of what this rage thing is that technology in some way is getting in the way of that through, you know, badly designed systems or difficulty in getting things modified or poor training. But we're also seeing, we asked this year, we wanted to find the extremes, and we asked people to indicate whether they thought verbal abuse or physical abuse or sabotage were increasing in their organizations as a result of IT. And 10% of people told us that it was. So we know there really is a hard core out there of IT-related frustration that needs more urgent attention.
Now, you've also mentioned security as an issue. What's happening there?
Yeah, 1 in 5 of the people who responded to our survey said that they felt that external systems security breaches had affected their organization over the past year. And that's huge, especially when you consider that 35% of those who said that this had happened, only 35% had reported it to the proper authorities. So we think that that's greatly understated. And security continues to be a very topical issue. And I think the big issue for us is that it's particularly been discussed since September the 11th. And I think it would be wrong for us to view the security issue as simply something that arises from a terrorist or a more extreme background. What we're seeing here is something related to security, general security weaknesses of systems related to commercial crime and that type of thing, and something that needs to be taken extremely seriously, not simply seen as something arising from terrorism, but something more broadly about the security of organizations.
Is this because there still aren't the programs in place to stop this sort of thing, or are there just some awfully smart people out there who can get around anything?
I think it's two things. I mean, I think it's partly a technical question, and it's also partly a management question, in the sense that there are a lot of organizations out there whose technology is still relatively weak, firewalls and that type of thing. And there's a lot of scope in existing technologies to do something about that. And also, I think, appropriately, the major technology companies are putting more emphasis than they used to on security as a part of their product. But no matter how good the technical fix is, there are still going to be the management issues. For the systems themselves to be used and benefit organizations, people need to be able to get into them. And I think this is especially relevant when we consider what's happening with technology now. More and more it's being used for work between organizations. And that, I think, is where the real vulnerability and hindrance may come. The technology offers the potential for organizations to work more closely together at a distance, to perform business-to-business transactions. And yet that has the potential to open up big security weaknesses. So, you know, solving these security problems is going to have a direct impact on our ability to apply technology in business-to-business ways.
How does that apply to internal security issues?
Yeah, we looked at that too, and we had a similar statistic there again, about 1 in 5. Organizations believed that they'd had a serious internal security breach of some kind. And I think that's important in relation to access to confidential information held on customers or employees. And again, you know, within organizations, the extent to which they can apply these technologies to make their businesses perform effectively will be strongly influenced by perceptions of that security.
Now, you mentioned there was some positive news out of this survey having to do with the way that e-business is expanding. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, I think there's some extremely positive news here. 58% of those who responded said they felt that IT had a significantly positive impact on their business performance, versus only 12% who felt that it hadn't. And you know, if we think back over the last few years, and even up to the last 10 or 15 years, that unanimity of support for technology was probably not as great as it is now, especially in the wake of the dot-com collapse. So I think that this is a very positive position for the technology sector, who will benefit from this, but also I think for organizations themselves.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Peter Carr, Acting Director of the Center for Innovative Management at Athabasca University. The Information Technology Survey is available online on the university's website. The big scientific debate today centers on bioethics. We have the technology to clone human beings and move the very essence of life between species. Yet just because we can do it, does that mean we should? Perhaps we can learn something by looking back at the dilemma faced by another man in another time, that of Galileo, the father of modern science. He dared to look through his telescope at the heavens and discovered the Earth was not the center of the universe. This was not what the church espoused, and for this heresy, Galileo was summoned to appear before the Holy Roman Inquisition.
How can I undo what is done? Discoveries are never undiscovered. Listen, the church relies on philosophy, on that which we cannot observe. But science is the exclusive domain of observables. Practice in science, then, must be divorced from the Holy Church. Science is not the better or the lesser than the teachings of the church. Science is and must remain separate. If I understand that to be the truth, am I thereby rendered godless in the eyes of the church? You must keep the faith. Which faith? Faith in God's truth or the truth of scientific method? It would seem that my faith imperils that of others. Surely to examine nature brings us closer to our Creator. God reveals only that which is ready to be revealed to our eyes. And what if this new knowledge is contrary to the Scriptures? You know very well the story of Joshua ordering the sun to stand still. So how do I contradict Holy Scripture in front of the Inquisitional Council? My daughter, Sister Maria, says perhaps scriptural interpretation does stand to be corrected. Oh, excellent. And what would Mother Abbess say if she could hear you now? No, daughter, Viviani and Torricelli are right. I am doomed.
Those are the tortured thoughts of Galileo, as performed by Chris Allen. The play is called Physics for Poets, and it was written by Athabasca teacher and playwright Gina Kravets.
Okay, the play is set 1632. It's the year that Galileo has received his third invitation from the Holy Roman Inquisitional Council. On this particular invitation, he does go. And the play occurs in one night, and it's the night that Galileo is preparing to travel from his home in Florence to Rome to appear in front of the Inquisitional Council. In the night, as he's preparing to make his journey, various individuals come to visit him in the night, and eventually they reveal to Galileo their own ideas about what he should do upon meeting with the Inquisitional Council. There's three forces. One is his daughter, Sister Maria Celeste. The other is a colleague of his, Torricelli, who we know is the inventor of the barometer. The other is young Viviani, who is a student of his, of minor nobility. The last force, and perhaps the most predominant force in the play, is Johann Kepler. Interestingly enough, Kepler's been dead for a few years, but he's in the play throughout, challenging Galileo.
Now, right away when you start off with the play, one of the most important things that carries through are these letters that Galileo has taken out of his desk or out of his drawer and asked his daughter to burn. And then, of course, she doesn't burn them. What is it that's in those letters that's bugging Galileo so much that he wants to get rid of them?
Yes, Galileo wants to get rid of the letters. Galileo did keep his correspondence. Kepler had indeed written Galileo on many occasions, asking Galileo to, well, for advice sometimes and for support, collegiality support. Galileo never responded, not once, to Kepler. However, in my play, Galileo has kept the letters. On the eve of his preparation to depart from Florence to Rome, Galileo has decided to do a little bit of house cleaning. And the first thing that must go are the Kepler letters. He's retrieved the letters, he's bundled them up, he's entrusted them to his daughter and given her instructions to destroy them. She doesn't. Various points throughout the evening, she opens the letters, has occasion to read them, and she's intrigued by them. And her choice is not to destroy them.
When you go through the play, reading through it, what becomes really obvious is that Kepler and Galileo themselves are fighting to uncover the truth, and yet are, it seems like they're, especially with Galileo, he's afraid of what it is that he's discovered. What is that?
Well, Galileo, of course, was relying on the burden of proof. I mean, he's coming at this saying, I'm right, and if you can prove me wrong, go ahead. But until you do that, I'm right. It's burden of proof. But even transcending that is the pursuit of truth. And you'll recall a scene in the play. Kepler challenges Galileo. What did it feel like? Feel like the first time to look through the telescope. That pure joy of discovery, the act of moving closer and closer to what we know today as a truth. That's a tremendous thing.
You've done an awful lot to go back 400 years and reach into the minds of the people of the time. How did you do your research? What did you consult?
Okay, well, first of all, I chose Galileo, okay, to structure the play around. He's considered by many to be the father of modern science and certainly of modern scientific procedure. So I consulted some fairly fundamental works on Galileo, and that led me into taking a look, too, at one book by Arthur Koestler, Sleepwalkers. That was a turning point for me. In that book, Arthur Koestler takes a good long look at the works of Johann Kepler, and I was intrigued with the counterpoint between Kepler and Galileo. So,
no counterpoint, what do you mean?
Well, Kepler was, and I suppose is by some, still considered to be a metaphysicist, okay? Kepler was one of these types who did not rule out intuition. He had some, I suppose, by today's standards, they could be considered almost metaphysical approaches into science. And even though a lot of Keplerian laws are agreed to be truths today, I suppose there are some who still might view Kepler as a bit of a misguided mystic. And he was somewhat. He was into, fairly mystical approaches into science, some intuitive approaches. And here's Galileo struggling very hard and successfully to develop scientific procedure, which, of course, we know is based on observables and empiricals. And that has become the structure of modern scientific practice today. which I wonder if that wasn't the, one of the reasons why Galileo might have been reluctant to respond to Kepler, whom he could have indeed has viewed as a misguided mystic at the time. And Galileo may have indeed wanted to stay very, very clear of that.
So in a sense, communication between the two, if they became associated, would actually taint Galileo? Was he worried about his reputation?
Certainly. I think that would be a factor. Galileo would be concerned that it would jeopardize his work, moving towards a pure science. And remember, Galileo wanted to create a science as a field separate unto itself, as separate from philosophy and as separate from theology, certainly from the church at the time. And Galileo perceived this as being a very happy and a very real possibility. Kepler keeps bugging Galileo with the whole concept that, hold on, things are interconnected, and how do we deal with that? Kepler even starts to hint at something called ethics, which Galileo is not prepared to answer to at all.
The knowledge, though, too, is power. And the church at the time doesn't want to give up its power over who knows what.
Right. And Galileo, I believe he probably met disfavor with the church, because Galileo truly believed information was power. He wanted to put it into the hands of people. And remember, at the time, scientists relied heavily on Latin. They wrote in Latin, they spoke to each other in Latin. That's the way it was done. Galileo wrote in the vernacular. He designed his writings and his discoveries in a fashion that anyone could read them, therefore making new truths, new discoveries available, readily available to whoever would take the time to pick them up.
And yet at the same time, he's not prepared to look at his own truth. There's a really neat passage in the play where Kepler is challenging Galileo, and he says, look what you've done. You've changed the order.
So what does your new proven truth do to the existing order of things? Not only have you set the earth adrift, there are those who would say you have very effectively transferred the power from his hands into your own. That is not your intention. Tell me, could you see God through your lens? Of course not. But where is your God? It is all well and good for one man, a man of science, to find a new vision. But what of the people in the fields? Might it not rain, or might pestilence strike down the crops should God not occupy his rightful place in the universe? You destroy the foundation of generations, however cracked it may be, then offer nothing to take its place. You shiver, my friend.
What did happen to him in the end?
In the end, well, he did appear in front of the Holy Roman Inquisitional Council. There was a series of hearings, ultimately. I think everybody who's gone through Science 10 will tell you that Galileo did recant. He was forced to tell a lie. He abjured, you know, that basically he said that what he had written about the Earth moving around the sun wasn't the truth. After this, they allowed Galileo to go home. He did. He returned to Florence. Remember, at the time, he was quite an elderly gentleman. His eyesight was failing. His health was failing. He did return to Florence, where he was tended to a degree by his daughter, and she wasn't confined to her convent, and by friends. Galileo did continue scientific endeavor up until he died.
It's interesting that he should be forced to tell a lie when the main things in the play that he's talking about is his faith in reason and logic, and that the people he was going to see in Rome were people that he had known who had been scientists and mathematicians themselves and people of logical thinking.
Right. Galileo placed everything in the value of reason, in the pursuit of truth. Galileo assumed that once he appeared in Rome, they would respond in a reasonable manner. Well, this didn't prove to be the case at all. here we have a great mind who assumes that people are going to accept ration, reason, you know, empirical evidence, and are going to respond rationally and reasonably. Well, perhaps Galileo's lesson is, perhaps the lesson we continue to live is maybe our world isn't as rational and as reasonable as we might like.
Thank you, Gina.
Thank you, Cheryl. I've really enjoyed this. Thanks.
I, Galileo Galilei, aged 70 years, kneeling before you, most eminent and reverend Lord Cardinals of the Inquisition, swear that I have always believed, do believe, and by God's help will in the future believe all that is held and taught by the Holy Catholic Church. Whereas I wrote and printed a book in which I discussed doctrine contrary to Holy Scripture, I have been pronounced by the Holy Office to be vehemently suspected of heresy, of having falsely believed and stated that the sun is the center of the universe and is immovable, and that the earth is not the center and moves about the sun. Therefore, desiring to remove from the minds of your eminences and of all faithful Christians this vehement suspicion brought against me, with sincere heart I abjure, curse, and detest the errors and heresies I stated regarding the motion of the earth, as they are contrary to the teachings of the Holy Church. I swear that in the future I will never again say, write, or assert anything that might cause a similar suspicion against me. Further, should I know any heretic or person suspected of heresy, I will denounce that person to the Inquisition. Further, I swear and promise to fulfill all penances imposed against me by this holy office. In the event of my contravening, which God forbid, any of these my promises and oaths, I submit myself to all pains and penalties imposed against my delinquency. I, Galileo Galilei, being of sound mind, testify to my aforesaid errors and heresies this 22nd day of June 1633. So help me God, and these his holy gospels which I touch with my hands.
Physics for Poets, a play by Gina Krivets. The roles of Galileo and Kepler were reprised by Chris Allen. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close. You can listen to all the past programs on the web. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Some thank yous are in order. Thank you to the sponsors who made this all possible. Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation, the Health Sciences Association of Alberta, and the Alberta Research Council. And thank you to all the people who so graciously welcomed me into your labs and your research facilities. And thank you to my two trusty and crusty technical producers, Scott Franchuk and Paul Pates. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Good night.